Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999. From Mumford here in 2022. I'm Mumford and this is my partner.
I thought you were going to say, and your son. I mean, that's what you should have done.
Mumford and Son. Oh, but my son. No, I wasn't even going to make one Mumford and Son joke. But the joke of Mumford is that the character's name is also Mumford. Which son is Mumford? And the character is Mumford.
What's amazing is when pressed as to why he chose that name, he confesses that he came up with Mumford first and then discovered there was a town named Mumford.
Well, he didn't come up with Mumford. He didn't pick it out of thin air. Okay. He picked Mumford because it was the last name of a child who died in his hometown. Okay.
My apologies. Right. I should have been more explicit.
All right. Yes, yeah. He did. He took the name Mumford, and then he went to Mumford. You know how you know all that? Because he just tells you.
He just tells you.
But yeah, here's the thing. Phil kind of liked it.
Yeah, I mean, here's
kind of liked Mumford.
I did. I didn't hate it. I guess I just. First of all, I remember Mumford was a gala at TIFF in 1990. I'm assuming 99, like September 99, before this film came out in September. Yeah, so it was like a gala 2 weeks or so before the movie comes out. Weirdly, I have like these like TIFF galas kind of burned in my brain because all the stars would kind of come to town and you would be on the covers of all the papers. And like Toronto Film Festival is obviously a very big deal in Toronto. So when these movies come there, especially the big studio films, you remember. So I remember this film being there and I just remember that's it. I remember no one really talked about the movie. The reviews for it were pretty kind of whatever. You know, we'll talk about Ebert's 3.5 out of 4-star review. He was maybe the biggest proponent of this movie. I don't think I knew what this movie was about other than a small town called Mumford. So when I pressed play on this thing and for the first half hour, I was like, okay, so
yeah,
the guy's a shrink and it's a small town and these people are kind of not really that quirky. It's kind of just whatever, you know, small town USA. And then the concept drops at about the 30-40 minute mark where you realize that he's
not. I think it was 45-50.
It's pretty deep into the movie.
Yeah.
for the concept to really become clear.
This might be one. I mean, we'll obviously talk about context, talk about things to talk about, but it might be worth running through it a little more closely than we normally do because it is an bizarre little piece of film. First thing is 1999. You don't see a lot of we haven't seen a lot of Touchstone movies.
Correct.
This is a Touchstone movie.
Yep.
The Touchstone title card up front. And it just you're probably 7-8 years removed from when they were really
sure.
I guess the heyday, but Touchstone probably had like a 7 to 10 year heyday. I think Splash was the first Touchstone film in 84. And I think by 94, they had completely lost track of what they are.
Because Disney became Disney, right? And Disney stopped. It felt like Disney stopped kind of feeling the need to have this arm in the same way.
I would say the other thing is Hollywood Pictures also became a thing.
Correct.
So Hollywood Pictures was making bigger movies, right? Mm-hmm. They were making your Bruckheimer movies and things like that.
Yep.
And they were able to make R-rated movies. I don't think Touchstone made R's. And and Touchstone has a certain, you know, has a certain veneer and tone, no pun, that didn't really work that well in the ironic late 90s.
Well, I'm looking at the list of their movies, just kind of scrolling through it to sort of hit your point. Because like it does feel like Bruckheimer gives them the biggest sort of wind at their back in the mid to late 90s, arguably the last kind of run they had where, you know, a big string of Armageddon's probably the last, and that's 98, but that's the biggest, I would argue. Pearl Harbor's also that, but you know what I'm saying.
Like, those movies don't feel like Touchstone movies at all. Like those movies.
Correct.
That, you know, this is really a time when, and we've talked about it so much, when the title card before a movie really meant something.
Yep.
It really gave you an idea of what kind of movie you're about to watch.
Yep.
And all I'm saying is, in terms of Touchstone, is this doesn't feel like a Touchstone movie, but it feels like a Miramax movie.
Yes.
But it like the shitty ones we've done, like the ones that came in the wake of Beautiful Girls, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like it is the result of some execs sitting in the room and saying, having a big whiteboard and saying, what is a Touchstone movie in 1999? What does a Touchstone movie look like? And they're like, it's a little bit edgier than before, but you have characters you like and you have, you know, you quirky dialogue, but not too quirky. Mm-hmm. It has to live in the real world. And, you know, the thing about Touchstone, and if you look down that list, I think you'll see it, is there's always a high concept, a medium to high concept in their movies.
Yep.
That this has, but just you're not allowed to know it until halfway through.
Well, it's interesting because like I'm going to just read through our 99 Touchstone movies because there's actually more of them than I
clocked, if I'm being completely honest. So I'm not going to count A Civil Action, which technically comes out January 8th, 99, but it was for Oscar consideration in December of 98. The Other Sister, 10 Things I Hate About You, Instinct, Summer of Sam, Runaway Bride, 13th Warrior, Mumford, Bringing Out the Dead, The Insider, Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, Cradle Will Rock, Bicentennial Man.
Everything I've said is wrong. Everything.
Well, no, I don't think it's what I think this pinpoints is they don't know what the fuck they are at this point.
They're nothing at this point.
At this point, they're just throwing spaghetti against the wall and trying to get into bed with big filmmakers.
The thing is, you and I are going on Billy Ray Bruton's podcast and we are doing Touchstone movies.
We are.
The reason we can pitch Billy Ray Touchstone movies is because Touchstone movies mean something. Like dimension means something.
Correct.
Like New Line to a certain extent means something, and you know what you're going to get. And as good as like The Insider is, because it's one of the best fucking movies. Yeah. I wouldn't put it on the list. It's not doing what we're trying to do with this thing.
I agree.
So it's not a Touchstone movie. You know what the biggest Touchstone movie we did this year? Mm. The Touchstone movie of the year that isn't a Touchstone movie.
Okay.
By far. Okay. Ed TV. That's a Touchstone movie, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, 100%.
If you want to watch a great Touchstone movie, go watch Ed TV.
It's like, I'm going to name a couple of these sort of late 90s Touchstone movies where you can see they're just scrambling, right? Like Ransom is a Touchstone movie. Ron Howard's a Touchstone filmmaker in my brain.
Oh my God.
Right? Like
100%.
100%. Right?
He made the first one.
You did.
And even, to me, it's funny because the biggest Touchstone movie ever is a movie that's not even a Touchstone movie is Parenthood. Like that's like the ideal Touchstone movie.
Totally. Yes.
And I believe it's Universal, right?
It is.
So, but yes, Ron Howard makes Touchstone films. Correct.
It's just like, so obviously in 89, we've talked, about Touchstone because big Touchstone, Dead Poets Society is probably one of the biggest Touchstone movies, right?
Big time. Yeah.
Pretty Woman, early 1990. That's a Touchstone movie. Although it's getting a little edgier, but still feels like it's in their corridor. The movie for me, that I associate with Touchstone Pictures the most, and I know we're going to go on this podcast and we'll have this conversation on another.
We'll see. I don't even know the format of this crazy podcast.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit is the quintessential Touchstone movie to me.
I wish you didn't mention that one.
I'm sorry, but it's the truth. I know we're having this conversation because of this.
Yeah, because I don't want to talk too much about it.
We won't talk too much about it. That's the whole package.
It's the best movie. But I think that's what Touchstone should have aspired to over and over again. That and another movie that's not a Touchstone movie, which is Back to the Future. These big four quadrant family films that are essentially are classic Hollywood storytelling, maybe fairy tales like Pretty Woman. I think if Ron Howard is a quintessential Touchstone director, the quintessential Touchstone actor is Robin Williams.
Yes.
Like it is
or a Tom Hanks even maybe. Depending on certain times.
Tom Hanks. Yeah. Like those guys who are safe and wonderful and lovable and make you feel great. This movie is so fucking weird.
I just want to say one other thing very quickly about Touchstone because I think it's worth noting and speaks to where it is now, which is that my roommate Melissa works at 20th right now. So she originally worked at Fox 21, which then was bought by Disney. Disney bought most of Fox and turned Fox 21 into Touchstone Studios. That was
so weird.
Which is weird because they basically were just like, what's a moniker that we have under our umbrella that kind of speaks to maybe cable-y things that we sort of want to do? Let's just call it Touchstone. So it becomes that, even though you might remember back in the day when we were at the agencies, Touchstone was the studio that that handled scripted Disney content. It's this weird brand. Yeah. Like, it's bizarre.
Yeah, right. I mean, then we're going back a ways, but back in the mid 2000s, all the studios had their own names. Like, it wasn't just ABC Studios, it was Touchstone, it wasn't NBC Studios, it was Universal. or NBC Universal.
Was it CBS? Studios. It was Paramount.
It was Paramount. CBS. What? CBS.
Which is insane to think of now.
That I don't know about CBS. That might have been a different, because there might have been a CBS Studios too, because CBS was whatever. They all had their own fucking names, and it all made sense, and everything felt right. And then they just smushed everything together. The ABC becoming ABC Studios was actually, Touchstone becoming ABC Studios was the one that kind of bugged me. that one was like, you guys don't care anymore. You're telling on yourself. At least let me think that it's,
you mentioned this earlier. I think it's worth mentioning now. The synopsis of Mumford, for people that have not watched Mumford, which based on its box office would be most of you. Dr. Mumford, played by Lauren Dean, is the new psychologist in a small town. His unique style of therapy draws many patients, including a billionaire played by Jason Lee, a woman with chronic fatigue syndrome played by Hope Davis. But Mumford also draws the ire of the town's two established doctors played by David Paymer and Jane Addams. Resentful of Mumford's success, they hire an attorney played by Martin Short to impugn...
It's not exactly how that happened, but okay.
No, not exactly at all. And together they reveal shocking secrets from Mumford's past. Mumford opened on September 24th, 1999. They don't reveal anything. He just tells people. The video opened against Double Jeopardy, Blue Streak, The Sixth Sense, and For Love of the Game. It would go on to make $4.6 million on a $28 million budget. It's got 57% on Rotten Tomatoes, 66 from audiences, 57 from critics. Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars and said, in a little town right down the imaginary road from Pleasantville and Seahaven, where Truman lives, a psychologist sets up shop. His name is Mumford. The town's name is Mumford. Mumford is also the name of a great writer on towns and cities, but any connections between these Mumfords are left unexplored. Folks are too busy living their lives to spare the time. Mumford is so carefully visualized in Lawrence Kasdan's new film that you'd love to live there yourself. This must read like a peculiar review. Does it make you want to see the movie? There are no earth-shaking payoffs here, no dramatic astonishments, vile betrayals, or sexual surprises. Just the careful and loving creation of some characters in a mostly pleasant place to be. And at its deepest level, profoundly down there, below the surface, is something more, I think. An expression of Kasdan's humanist longings, his wish that people would listen better and value one another more. It's the strangest thing how this movie sneaks up and makes you feel a little bit better about yourself. I mean, I really can't argue with any of that, but...
A couple things.
Yeah, please.
One, I really like the way the whoever writes up the Google things, like, tried to put a plot there. It was like, so wait, what was this movie about? That makes no sense. It can't possibly be what actually happened.
Yeah, they're like, I'm gonna do a pass.
They did a pass on it. They did a pass on it. Like they So that was great. Secondly, like Ebert's review, because I rated it beforehand before I read any reviews, but Ebert's review makes me want to shout, this movie sucks. Like, there's I don't think this movie sucks. I really don't. Like, I think it kind of is okay, but I'll tell you, here's the thing. You know how we say the movie, this movie doesn't work. Like the movie, this movie doesn't work. This movie is inept in almost every fucking way. However, I love Hope Davis.
I love most of the cast, by the way.
I mean, the cast, it's a crazy fucking thing to say, but like, I found Lauren Dean to be really fucking winning. And I know it sounds crazy, but like he could, it's such a weird fucking role. And it's so, it's just, I will get into it. It's so like bizarrely written. It's not his fault, but I feel like he did somehow find a cohesive through line throughout this character. And this character is, let's talk about it. This character is insane.
Yeah.
All right.
No, his character is yeah. Like
this is a blank check special. This is Larry Kasdan casting something in and saying, Star Wars, let's do whatever I want, right?
Let's talk about Lawrence Kasdan for a second, because I think that's a good place to start in terms of just a little bit of context of, I mean, okay, Lawrence Kasdan, who, you know, known for writing Empire Strikes Back, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Larry Kasdan. Yeah. His first film in 81 is Body Heat. Then he makes The Big Chill in 83, which is obviously an enormous success. He makes Silverado in 85. He makes The Accidental Tourist in 88. Love You to Death in 90. Grand Canyon in 91. Wyatt Earp in 94. French Kiss in 95. Mumford, 99. Dreamcatcher, 2003.
One of the worst movies I've ever seen.
One of the worst movies ever made. Darling Companion, which doesn't really exist. And then he, you know, recently wrote Solo and I don't know, went scorched earth on a bunch of people. He's got some movie called November Road, which is supposed to come out, which he wrote and directed, which is TBA. An interesting career as a director. Obviously, one of our greatest writers. I mean, a tremendous writer.
Yeah.
You know, I think
a lot of big fucking movies there that he directed.
Big movies and big ensembles, right? Yeah. The Big Chill is one of the biggest ensembles ever in terms of just being the quintessential hangout movie. Oh, I mean,
those are hard to do. That's that's one of those ideas I think every screenwriter has ever had when they're 22 mm-hmm. years old. Mm-hmm. And to be the one that actually makes it work, to be that or to be a diner or,
it's incredible.
Or a Dazed and Confused. It is a pretty amazing feat to make that thing work.
100%. And listen, I respect
when everybody has a preconceived notion of how that works, you know?
Right.
So I'm sorry.
But sticking the landing, it's really the only movie, one of the only movies that's done it. I respect the fact that as a filmmaker, he strives to, it's clear that, like, from your Wyatt Earps and what have you, that the guy longs to do big classical kind of, mm-hmm. you know, old school movies. Again, I respect that. This feels very Frank Capra. This feels very much like he wants to play in that sandbox.
Until the middle.
Like, and then it just turns into something completely different. He's a baffling film. I mean, Grand Canyon, for all intents and purposes, is basically just The Big Chill but grown up. I think French Kiss is a great rom-com.
Yeah, I think French Kiss is a good movie. I think people we have to. I feel like it's too fucking weird to just keep dancing around what happens in this movie.
Yeah,
What happens in this movie? Because that synopsis is not what happens in this movie. And I'm not just saying that like in a glib way. Like some of those things happen in this movie, and those characters are definitely in this movie.
They are in this
movie. That's not what happens in this movie. What happens in this movie is imagine Punxsutawney, the scenes when Bill Murray goes to the overwhelmed psychologist. With the overwhelmed psychologist, right? Yeah. So Lauren Dean, who is Joe from Say Anything, someone I never knew had any kind of career after this, let alone a starring role 10 years
I remember
later.
Him in Apollo 13. I remember really liking him.
He was in
Apollo
13.
But that's ultimately the only thing that's ever stood out for me from him outside of Say Anything.
Never knew he was anything. So He's Joe and Say Anything. He is our lead in this movie. He looks, he's got the same face, but he's got the exact same haircut I have right now. A typical dorky boy cut. And
he's just so white bread. He's so vanilla, unfortunately, aesthetically. I mean, he might be imbuing this with more than that, but
I totally agree with you, man. He is as central casting white guy as possible.
Correct.
And the funny thing is, like in Say Anything, his thing is that like he's very good looking, which he is.
He's good looking.
Like he's like alluring. They shoot him with backlight, and that's the only thing he has to offer. Lily Taylor. But whatever. Okay, so he's a psychologist in a small town. He has somehow managed to get more patients than the two established mental health professionals in town. There's David Paber, who's a psychiatrist. There's Jane Addams, who is a psychologist, and he apparently has more clients than both of them, or patients than both of them combined.
It's worth stating, doesn't seem particularly good at the job. people like to talk to him. His mm-hmm. superpower is that for whatever reason, people open up to this guy. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't really give them any particularly construct, like he's not doing anything to better their lives, as far as I can glean.
There is a sense, and I agree with this, there is a sense throughout, a lingering little thing that like,
yeah.
He's, you know, you and I have both been in therapy, and I think 95% of the people who listen to this podcast have been in therapy.
Uh-huh.
You watch this and you're like, this guy's not a great therapist.
Nope.
Like, not a overtly bad therapist. It's correct. Not like there's a joke there, you know? It's not like that show that's coming out where the therapist becomes a vigilante on behalf of her patients. That's not him.
He's not as bad as, say, like Neil Patrick Harris in Matrix Resurrections.
Right. He's not. He's just like not great. But he listens, and he's not like super bad. Like there's the it starts.
He doesn't seem engaged though. He doesn't seem like he cares. Well,
the first thing he does is he kicks a patient out. The first shot is you get this black and white dreamy sequence of a buff man who's about to like have sex with a landlady or something.
Yeah,
and you find out it's just the, you know, the fantasies of an overweight guy sitting on his couch, and he kicks him out.
Crazy.
He kicks him out, and he kicks this guy out, and you're like, well, all right, that's. Like
out of frustration that this patient wasn't digging deeper into his psychosis and was just kind of telling stories, I guess.
It feels like, it feels like, all right, so he's a non-traditional kind of therapist, but like maybe we're supposed to sympathize with the therapist. Like, wouldn't it be great if you're a therapist and you just kick out the guys you don't like? Then he does the same exact thing to Martin Short.
Yep.
Who's just annoying? Who's this patient who's just annoying? You're like, all right, so you kind of got to be a good patient to be this guy's patient. You kind of got to earn it. Maybe that's part of what's going on here. Then pretty quickly, like he starts giving away. He starts talking about his patients to other patients and to other people,
which is obviously, you know,
obviously. So, and like Alfred Woodward runs the local or owns the local, like, you know,
diner,
dirty, you know, like Dirty Spoon diner thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's his best friend. And he just goes there and has lunch every day and tells her, you know, what all the weirdos are doing. And, you know, and I guess this is the reason I kind of like Lauren Dean's performance, because even then I wasn't like, this guy's a piece of shit. I'm like, all right, what's going on here? You know, like, I think it was more like, it wasn't like, it was
yeah,
just like,
because yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's so matter of fact about it. He's monotone, but not in a way where he's not giving it. It's just in a way where that's like the performance style he's giving. It's very odd. So
I also think there's just one other thing worth mentioning here. So I'm sure that our audience has gleaned that we start this movie essentially in media res. Okay, like we are thrown in the deep end.
Yeah,
which isn't necessarily a problem for me, but this movie doesn't seem particularly committed to it. So you feel a little bit discombobulated in terms of like, what am I supposed to be feeling like I'm just part of this town? What am I? You just genuinely don't know how you're supposed to feel as this film opens for a good like 20 minutes to a half an hour.
Which like here's the thing.
Terrible,
in 1990, now I think this is relevant.
Yeah.
In 1999, Analyze This also comes out.
Correct.
Analyze This starts the same fucking way. You're with Billy Crystal, the therapist, who is your point of entry, who has to deal with annoying patients, and you are supposed to sympathize with him. So, and I think this has happened so many times in movies. So you know, it's. There is a sense of place and setting, and I mean context that we get from understanding movies that correct. This is what it is. But then he starts doing these really odd weird, unprofessional things. So he gets a few more clients or patients.
Hope Davis being one of them.
Hope Davis, who very clearly has, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome.
Is that a thing?
Yes, okay. It's a thing. I don't know if it's a thing that you would see a psychologist for, but it's a thing.
Okay.
So Hope Davis has that, and he also has Zooey Deschanel, and he also has Mary Steenburgen. And
Mary Steenburgen is in this movie. You mean Mary McCormick.
Sorry, Mary McCormick. and he has like a bunch of guys, and he takes on Skipperton, who's Jason Lee, who is the local tech billionaire, who skateboards around town.
Yeah. Who created a modem company, like a tech company?
Panda modem. Yeah. I think he has like 26% of all the modems in the country. Like he's a genial billionaire who can't connect with.
What did you think of Jason Lee in this movie?
I hated him. Hated.
And I usually love Jason Lee. Just to be clear,
yeah.
There's something affected about his performance in this, which is clearly intentional and probably directed.
Definitely.
But like, there's something very kind of like, it's like Mayberry, but it just doesn't work for me. Anyway,
Jason, you know, look, every actor every actor has modes in which they work and modes in which they don't. Him with all the edges sawed off, which is kind of what this character felt like to me, or sanded off. It wasn't really working for me, but there is a reason why he is who he is and he is the character he is. And that's because after Lauren Dean proves to be like kind of a good therapist and everyone seems to come back and everyone seems to get a little better. Like Mary McCormick is a hoarder who gets a little better. And Zooey Deschanel has, you know, body dysmorphia and gets a little better. And like everyone's getting a little better and everyone kind of loves him. And Lauren Dean is just going on hikes with Jason, with playing catch with him and going on hikes with him and telling him all of his clients' problems. And Jason Lee is finally like, why do you do that? So Lauren Dean's just like, you know, I probably shouldn't. He's like, I'll take that under advisement. You're right. Not a great thing that I do. And that's it. But then So this is the movie. And by the way,
Jason Lee tells him a big secret, okay? Which is that Jason Lee tells him that in his basement, he has built a laboratory where he is creating synthetic women.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. So, he tells him this secret, which to say out loud really gives you a sense of how fucking crazy this movie is.
And we also get to go to the laboratory.
This movie
is the wildest swings.
Is one of the horniest in the weirdest way movies I've seen in a long time.
It's so fucking weird.
So he tells him that he's building a laboratory or has a laboratory, he's building synthetic women. Lauren Dean tells him, that's not so weird, which it's pretty weird, but okay.
He said on a scale from 1 to 10, it's a 2.
Right.
I'm like, well,
I think it's like a 5 or 6 at minimum. No,
the thing that Lauren Dean does, which is like the weirdest part about it all, he's like, I think that's a good idea. He's like, he's like, that's not a secret. Like, you're going to be rich.
So he tells him that he thinks it's not weird, but you're going to get rich. And then he says, I got a secret for you. And Jason Lee says, oh, what's your secret? I'm not a doctor. Record scratch at the 45 minute mark of this movie, where
I just want to go back like half
please,
a moment.
Please.
Because yes, that's the secret, guys, if you hadn't figured it out. But the other part from the Google thing is David Paymer and Jane Addams are therapists in town who are like, I guess they're like having an affair or they're just together or something. They have
weird energy between them. Not really sure if it's sexual or not, but there's something.
Well, at some point, David Paymer says it is. They have a thing. And, you know, the psychiatrist and psychologist, they don't really duplicate each other. They're not really rivals. Martin Short like had one bad session with Lauren Dean and goes to them is like, this guy's a fraud. And like, the thing is like, he's so obviously right. Like at this point, like I'm like, he's a fraud. Like I know what's going on here.
Yeah.
Like I think I get it. But the thing about now we're at the part where we talk about the Google synopsis, 99 out of 100 movies at this point, would then start you down the road of the investigation. mm-hmm. where these three people or Martin Short or whoever or someone they hire starts to hound Lauren Dean. And Lauren Dean is, and they do it a little, then they do it after he confesses. So there's no tension in those scenes. Confesses to Jason Lee. So the audience is aware. The other people aren't. So there's, you would have that moment where he's starting to get hounded, but you don't. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a choice.
I don't need the same plot that I expected.
Uh-huh.
You don't need to do the obvious thing, but in the absence of the obvious thing, what they do is they have Lauren Dean confess to Jason Lee in a 15-minute sequence shot like
POV.
Like a fucking Paul Schrader movie. About it's like it's
bizarre.
Like a it's like a Paul Schrader meets exploitation movie about
it's kind of like the opening of the I don't know if you watched the premiere of Euphoria this season, but
that's what the opening of Euphoria feels like. Oy.
Kind of is.
And this
it's all like handheld POV, grainy saturated like, colors. You don't see his face through the entire sequence where it's he's like doing coke.
It's all first person.
It's insane.
It's all first person. And like, if I remember correctly, and I really don't, but Lauren Dean is a loser from West Virginia who worked a series of jobs, wound up.
He was like an exterminator. And he has like an epiphany while he's getting rid of termites that he wants to be an IRS agent.
Yes. So he wants to be an IRS agent. So he goes and becomes
an IRS. What is this movie?
It's amazing. He goes and becomes an IRS agent. Starts at like the bottom and like works at like, and there are a lot of like, you know, different jobs in the IRS and all the good jobs, bad jobs, whatever. And one and like winds up having like the best job, which is like an IRS investigator. So he hooks up with like this guy Greg, who's like a IRS cowboy.
Fox.
And he's like an IRS cowboy, and he's the best guy they got. And they basically are going in, but the job is not really to go and like kill people. It's to go and take pictures of people taking like getting handouts. It's so weird. So he winds up. Yeah, and he also has a coke problem through the whole thing. So Lauren Dean, every time you come back, he's like, it all came back to the cocaine. I just love that cocaine. So, you know, how do I get more cocaine? I need more money. How do I get more money? I get a better job. So I got a better job, got more cocaine. So,
and then he fucks his partner's wife.
Yes,
you see that graphically.
He fucks his partner. He has an affair. He falls in love with his partner's wife, and then he blows it, and then he gets in a fight. And then I kind of tapped out at this weird ass part. And the whole time, Jason Lee's sitting there and being like, And Lauren Dean, every time he says something crazy, he's like, and that's not the crazy part. And like at the end, I think someone dies in this flashback. Like
I don't remember
someone they were looking for, some cheat who wasn't that bad. Like he dies accidentally, and then Mumford.
And then we finally see his face in the bathroom mirror,
he
looks messed up. Yeah.
Jared Leto would have played this character great. You would have beaten this up.
Did you read who originally was cast, but then he was unavailable? Johnny Depp.
I would have hated that.
I mean, I'm not sure I would have liked it either.
I would have hated that. I think
But like this stretch of the movie, like this portion of the film with Johnny Depp, just this flashback section, I would buy 100%. The problem is I wouldn't buy the aw shucks. We're talking about Blow, right? Which is a whole movie that he basically.
Yeah, I guess all I'm saying is like part of the charm of this movie for me.
Yeah.
Is that nobody seems to be in on how ridiculous it is. And Johnny Depp is too smart to play this straight. So like this whole sequence is so ridiculous. And so like Roger Ebert's review is so weird because he ignores this middle like 15-minute, you know, tangent into you know, a fucking into taxi drivers, into a taxi driver story with like full frontal and all these things and lines of coke, like right out there, and guns in the middle of a movie that essentially takes place in Mayberry with really nice people who like might want to have a little more sex than they're having. Like, that's really what it comes down to. Like, the job, like the problem for most of these people is like, I don't really have sex enough. Like, not, and they're not like, I'm trying to find all
repressed.
This time.
Yeah.
A little repressed. Exactly. It's this crazy part in the middle of this movie. And
I think you kind of hit it on the nail on the head a little bit with the casting, the Lauren Dern, Johnny Depp casting, because ultimately the
Lauren
role,
Dean, it's weird. Lauren Dean, sorry. Same as Dern,
ultimately the character of Mumford needs to be so bland and unassuming that his con, quote unquote, works, right? But he also needs to be compelling enough and have sort of this like seedy kind of underbelly, or at least believe that, which is an impossibility, and also speaks to the problem with the film as a whole, which is that it's trying to be those two things. It wants to be this unassuming, lovely little character piece about a small town, but also fucking crazy with, like, you know, synthetic women and coke. And you're just like, oh, I wish that the film had the courage of its convictions to be able to wrap its arms around how weird it wants to be. But instead, it's just like this kind of weird in between nothing.
It's funny that you Freudian slipped into Laura Dern, because this is what happens when people who aren't David Lynch try to do David Lynch.
Which, like, sure.
This is sure. Like, because there are so many little ways. Like, there's so many little ways to make this movie better. 100%. This isn't like in and of itself the worst idea. It's the execution is so fucking weird.
Yep.
Like, there are so many movies about people who have a previous identity, from The History of Nobody or The History of Violence to Mr. Nobody, which came out last year. Like, this thing is pretty, you know, the template's pretty well worn here, and that's not that hard to fit something into. You don't have to go by the template, of course, but just spitting out everything in the middle of the film, and then when the audience knows everything, have some of the characters catch up to it, robbed it of all its tension and totally was disjointing for the audience. Like, it again, it's okay if we were hypothetically, if we got all this information in the first act or very early on, and then we were with some of these characters a little more, particularly Hope Davis's character, as she starts to realize, I'm not only seeing a fraud psychologist, I'm falling for a fraud man. Mm-hmm. But at that point, you know, the biggest thing that I think they fucked up is when Lauren Dean told Skip Skipperton, Skip Skipperton was cool with it. So it's just very simple shit, but he had to lose. Like, he kind of had nothing. We already know he has nothing to fear. Like, this is one of those movies now where, like, The Music Man, right? Where the con man is going to be embraced as soon as he comes clean. Which is what
I would argue
happens.
That the legal system isn't even that upset about it. He's doing a maximum of 3 months in jail.
I know.
He's probably going to get it sooner.
The judge goes, the judge is like, people seem to like you. Doesn't matter.
I'm blowing the book at you.
No, the maximum sentence I can give you under the law is 6 months, which is a travesty. A travesty. I'll give you 3 months.
It's like, huh?
What just happened?
Hope Davis even makes a joke.
I know.
It's only a couple of weeks, whatever. I'm not going anywhere.
He's all right. So, like, fast forward, like, him and Hope Davis fall in love. Hope Davis is obviously winning. She's fantastic, truly fantastic. I love her. At the end of the movie, like, you know, the big reveal is that he, you know, who who saves her by like taking her on walks or something, cures her of her chronic fatigue syndrome, and they fall in love. Like, she shows up the first day and she is, they have invented some kind of ghost makeup for her. She is
so pale.
So pale. And she gets her color back and everything's better. And for half a second, it comes out that he's not a real doctor. And then she follows him out. She's like, yeah, you should have told me.
But I love you.
I love you. Who needs a real doctor when you have a guy who will go on a paper route with you, which is what he does. Somehow he gets a paper route. Not sure what exactly what happened there.
It just doesn't feel like this was well thought out. Like, the script is such a kitchen sink thing of like, I have all these little things that I want to kind of throw together. I've got all these characters. I actually had a very similar takeaway from the film that Ebert did, in the sense that I think that thematically, I love the idea or the notion that this film is about people just need to talk to each other more and they need to be more open with each other. I think that's a lovely sentiment. I don't think it's a thing that you can, you can't hang a whole movie on that idea, but it's a nice idea. I just don't think this movie has that many ideas, quite frankly. Like, I don't really think it has that much to say.
No, it doesn't.
I don't think our main character learns anything or changes, really, kind of at all.
Not really.
He's in the back of a cop car, but he's still listening to a person talk to him at the end. Like, it's the same thing.
At the end of the movie, the cop is like, you're the doctor. He's like, well, you didn't hear, I'm not a doctor. That's why I'm back here. And the guy's like, well, I'll give it a shot anyway. And I'm sure in prison he becomes a prison doc. I'm surprised they didn't do the denouement in jail where his cell becomes like a little that's a great little stick. You could have had a little office, some guy in a prison cot back telling him his problems and him kicking him out. And by the way, the weirdest part is Martin Short is his lawyer at the end.
Ted Danson, who plays a son of a bitch in this movie, by the way. He's great. Yeah. He's a real prick, though.
He plays a real prick, but I kind of liked him. It's just a weird, bad, dumb movie I don't know. It just feels like Kasdan shot like a first draft. Not even a first draft. It almost feels like, remember we did Three Kings? Mm-hmm. And the thing was that John Ridley was like, I'm going to write the film as fast as I can.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like Lawrence Kasdan was always like, I think I could write this in 36 hours. I think I could do it.
This weekend I can get it done. Yeah.
I think he wrote it in about 36 hours on a coke binge. Or like he did the thing that like I always think about doing, which I never actually do, which is like run through my old ideas and be like, I'm just going to put two random ideas together and see what happens. Yeah. Character is going to go with this movie. Now what? And I think he's like, I have this guy, I have this idea about an IRS agent who fakes his own death and takes on someone else's personality, which that was the whole thing. The whole thing was like, because he was in the IRS, he understands how to forge documents. Yes. And it's so easy. So, sure. And he was like, it's so easy. I don't even have to tell you how to do it. It's so easy. Like, just trust me. I was in the IRS. And then he's like, and then I also have this idea about this small town. I love small towns. And you have the guy come and he's pretending to be a shrink and fireworks. He'll fall in love. There'll be some sex parts. We'll have a synthetic woman from this other script that I, from my, I can't believe he was involved with the writing of Solo because.
Well, yeah.
Remember the only part of Solo that was really cool?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Remind me?
Fucking Donald Glover.
Well, I was going to say,
falling in love with his robot.
And essentially fucking her, it seemed.
Yeah, him and the robot were like deeply in love. Yeah, I wonder if
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the robot.
I wonder if that was that, you know, if that was a
vestige of Mumford.
A disregarded, you know, scene from Mumford. He's like, I had this idea that Jason Lee would like fall in love with this woman, but I can use it in Solo. It makes, you know, because that is like that. That is so, that part is so Gaga that,
But here's the thing about Mumford, about the guy Mumford, but Lauren's character, is he's not shocked by anything. So everything that comes at him, he's essentially non-reactive.
Right.
Okay. Which makes him boring to watch, right? Because you're not getting a rise out of him. He's just a flat line through most of this film. So
I don't disagree. You could certainly read that as boring. I was fascinated that they turned the camera on this guy. It's like, you know, sure. Andy Warhol had those experimental movies like Empire, where he literally just shot the Empire State Building for 8 hours and then made people watch it. There's something like that. There's like that kind of
quality. Oh, shit. I'm not saying that you're right. Boring is the wrong word. He's not compelling to watch. There's something interesting that you're sort of like, why is this guy not more, I don't know, aghast by this synthetic woman laboratory, you know, with these thrusting pelvises on tabletops. Why does he not seem all that upset by it?
So weird.
You know, even, you know, we've kind of breezed past her, but the Zooey Deschanel character, this is Zooey Deschanel's first performance. It's her first film. David Iserson, past and future guest, was tweeting with him about this because I guess he went to school with Zooey Deschanel and she dropped out when she got this role and decided that she was going
to,
you know,
well, her and Jason Ritter, who's also in this movie, both went to Crossroads in LA. They were the same year.
Jason Ritter looks like a child in this. I mean, he's so young, but
I guarantee you Jake Kasdan was a Crossroads kid too. Like, it just seems like, you know, one of those things where Lawrence Kasdan was like, that friend of yours and that friend of yours, they're both kind of cool.
They're both great. I like them. Yeah. I like their look. I mean, Zoe's look in this film is actually kind of funny because it's sort of the beginning of Zoe. And I wonder whether or not she honestly looked this way when she walked into the audition and he was just like, yes, that. Like Zooey Deschanel obviously has made her aesthetic a thing. So there's a part of me that feels like she walks in some version of this.
Yeah,
you know, and by that I mean, if you want to see what she looks like, Google it. But she, you know, big black eyeliner, crazy spiky hair, sort of this pseudo 50s kind of odd vintagey thing. I didn't hate her look. I love Zooey Deschanel. I don't have a problem with Zooey Deschanel, but I felt like this role was underwritten, and I'm not totally convinced that she's the right casting for what he wanted the role to. The role needed to be pricklier. It certainly felt like to other people she was a more broken sort of, you know, Island of Misfit Toys kind of thing. And she just doesn't, it just didn't really totally click.
It wasn't a great role, but it's almost like the poster for this movie is like Hollywood Square. Someone said it in Twitter.
Yes.
And at that point, it was just nice that it was, you know, a face I knew. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like that is just like that's just like because there is this, you know, when you have a Hollywood Squares-esque poster, which happens every once in a while. Like I remember Full Frontal had one. Part of the Brady Bunch poster. Mm-hmm. Part of the fun is just the people who show up and the Martin Shorts and the David Paymers and the Zooey Deschanels and the Mary McCormick's, and it's a more fun cast than Playing by Heart. It's a much better movie than Playing by Heart.
Yes. I mean, a low bar, but yes. I mean, part
low
of the reason,
bar, but yes.
I mean, there's a part of
so
part
much of the, better,
so much better. But part of the reason is that this movie's just so much stranger. Like playing by heart is boring because they're not doing anything particularly interesting. And then the conceit of all these kind of fragmented stories, it's just lazy. It's exhausting.
It's just twee. It's
yeah.
I know. Yes. And I think exhausting and lazy actually mean the same thing in that like they're doing no work, so you have to do all the work.
100%.
This movie is doing all the work. It's just like you're just, yeah. just at the end, you're just like, why'd you do all that?
Really, because it's like
it's doing all the dot connecting for you. It's doing because there is nothing subtle
handing
about
you everything.
It's
you
yeah, have, it's yeah, like, yeah. Here's the movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
I think that the thing about playing by heart and this, playing by heart, you know how I'm sure you've heard this, you know, one of the biggest lessons when it comes to writing is specificity, right? Like
yes.
if there's something specific, there's a character is living in a specific world, they have a specific viewpoint on the world, like people will latch on to that. But when it's vague, it's just harder to do that. And I think that playing by heart is vague as shit. This movie is specific. It's oddly specific about the things it's decided to focus on, but there is specificity to it. I don't hate it.
I don't even know how to explain it. Like it's, I am not. Anyone who listens to the Screencast Razzie episode knows this. And just if you've been a fan of this podcast, you know this. I don't believe in so bad it's good. I don't get off on so bad it's good.
Yeah.
Except with Mumford.
That's the full quote for this episode.
There is something about this film that does kind of tickle me that I just kind of like, I think you can kind of get into how wacky and silly and straight-faced and you know, the fact that Ebert gave it 3.5 stars. Like, I love this. Like, I do. I think I love it.
Here's what I want to say. I want to hone in on the so bad it's good idea, because similar to yourself, I don't disagree. I don't believe in films that that are so bad that they somehow transcend. But what I do believe in are movies that are so bad they're enjoyable and you have a good time with it. Like, and that you get on its level. Like, I think that's why you and I to some degree liked this movie, right? Because we were just like, I don't know why you exist, Mumford. Yeah. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm kind of willing to go on this ride with you. Whereas we've covered much worse films than Mumford over the course of this podcast that I just was exhausted by, or just felt like I can't, I don't know.
So as always, it's a matter of intent, right? So
yeah.
And we always assume intent, but I think with a filmmaker like Lawrence Kasdan, I think I'm giving him credit by saying there's no way you intended this movie to be this unintentionally funny. Like, there's no way the things about this movie that we are really kind of enjoying are things you meant to do. Because if you meant to do that, like, you're a weird, bad filmmaker and you're not you. Like, he was clearly, very clearly, I think, trying to make a who's a good example of a guy who makes movies like this and they land?
Like, Robert Altman.
Yeah, I think Altman's a good example of that. I mean, I was thinking of Altman early on before the twist.
Even Dr. T and the Women, which is not one of my favorite, the Richard Gere one, which is not one of my favorite films, but again, small town doctor dealing
is
with
that,
all these.
Is that 99? Oh, no. What do we get if it's a 99?
Cookie's Fortune, which is also a small town movie too. Yeah. So like, I think no one does ensembles, I would argue, better than Altman does, because he understands how, when to kind of check in with people and when Altman's it's okay for these things, for people to kind of be ships passing in the night in a way that's interesting.
I was thinking more like, I mean, Altman is a good example on the ensemble part. I'm thinking more on the like the quirk part, like maybe Pleasantville. Pleasantville is a good example. I was going to say Coen Brothers, like their lighter stuff.
Sure.
Raising Arizona and Lady Killers and the films that I guess people love Raising Arizona, but the films I don't connect with quite as well, but are clearly very well done. And the thing about those movies and everything the Coens do is like they're totally consistent, like so consistent. You are so nothing about them feels like you were in unsteady hands. And this movie is so unsteady that it's so clearly a mistake. That being said, I kind of feel it. Like, I kind of feel like this wacky ass shit. And the thing is, we did Story of Us this year, which is another guy similar to Lawrence Kasdan, who was just killing it in the 80s and who just kind of fell off hard. But there's nothing about that movie that's fun. There's nothing about that movie that's weird. That movie is twee and you know, preposterous, and the dialogue's bad, and any attempts to cut back and forth are awkward. And it's attempting to be a serious story within the confines of, you know, a Rob Reiner relationship comedy thing. And it just doesn't work. Whereas, like, God, if I know what this movie's trying to do.
Well, like, so two things came to mind as you were speaking. The first is an idea came to me that I think would be fun, which is as we come to the end of our 1999 run, if we pulled monologues from movies and got actors to come on and deliver them. The reason is the Michelle Pfeiffer monologue at the end of Story of Us is some of the most batshit crazy
about
monologues.
The restaurant?
The idea that like you and I could potentially bring on a couple actors, someone to do like Nicole Kidman's Eyes Wide Shut speech, or and do Michelle Pfeiffer's Chinese food speech. I think it'd be fun. I think it's a good idea. The second thing, and the more salient to what we're talking about, is something occurred to me as I was looking at his filmography just now, which is right after this film, he does Dreamcatcher. Lawrence Kasdan, Stephen King is the quintessential small town guy. And I think that there's something there in terms of like this film kind of weirdly sort of has Stephen King-y vibes in it, specifically that flashback sequence, specifically a character posing as something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not a surprise to me that he goes right into a ill-advised Dreamcatcher after this. It's just interesting.
I think Dreamcatcher's the worst we've ever seen in theaters.
I wish that was a Razzie, man. If that had been a Razzie winner,
I would have hated to watch it. But the thing with Dreamcatcher is
ass aliens.
You know, I saw it, poop aliens. I saw it, you know, right away. So like there wasn't any like time to digest it. I didn't see it on video or DVD. Right. There wasn't any fun to be at. It was just like, I'm gonna see this Stephen King movie. And then I was very upset.
Yeah.
I know there are people who think like it's an intentional, just a lark. Mm-hmm. Like, right. I think like Morgan Freeman thought he was making a fucking lark, right? like his eyebrows are, it's
so good.
So like, I don't know, like that. And then maybe I'll go back to giving Larry
Crocker catcher again.
Who's like Damian
Lewis is in. Okay. So it's Thomas Jane, Jason Lee, Damian Lewis, Timothy Oliphant, Morgan Freeman, Tom Sizemore, Donnie Wahlberg. Woof.
Good cast. Yeah. It was like 2002?
2003, yeah.
Good cast of guys who would be in that movie at that time.
Can I just say, though, that movie is adapted by William Goldman and Lawrence Kasdan. Like, how is that not the greatest screenplay that's ever been written?
I think they were fucking around. So like was he fucking around with this movie? Because he like ultimately know. He was like ultimately like
well, yeah
you know I've told this story about I mean everyone knows who I'm talking about, but I'm mm-hmm. I won't yeah, say his yeah, name
yeah. Sure.
But I had a boss who in like season six of a show I worked on.
I wonder if our sleuths will be able to put this together.
Sometimes we finish the script,
yeah,
and it wasn't that great. And he'd say, "Well, we gave him 80 great ones. Who cares if there's not?" Right? Like I wonder if Kasdan's like, I gave him Empire. I gave him Raiders. I gave him a big fucking chill. Right? Yeah. Choke on Mumford, motherfucker,
and Dreamcatcher.
Dreamcatcher is like. Dreamcatcher is almost like through the void, right? Dream Catcher's like, now, like, insane. Now, like, you're like, I'll do whatever. Like, you're telling me you want me to write the Ass Aliens movie? Okay. Like,
I'm going to read you just a very quick quote from him. In a 2012 interview during a promotional tour for his film Darling Companion, Kazan admitted that the commercial failure of Dreamcatcher left him wounded career-wise, but not so much personally. I've been personally wounded by other movies where I'd written it and thought, oh God, the world's not interested in what I'm interested in. With Dreamcatcher, the career was hurt. I was planning to do The Risk Pool with Tom Hanks. I'd written the script from a great book by Richard Russo, and it didn't happen. Then another one didn't happen. Meanwhile, 2 years have passed. 2 years have passed. That's how you get wounded. I mean, listen, The Risk Pool with Tom Hanks would have been fucking cool. I mean, Richard Russo's a great writer, you know, and Tom Hanks and Lawrence Kasdan make sense together. But yeah, after Dreamcatcher, it's like, you did Poop Aliens. I mean, anyway.
It is crazy to think that Lawrence Kasdan's career outside of Solo, which was its own bizarre, like, he didn't write that in the beginning. He was brought on. So he was brought on to save it.
His son was the main writer, and he...
Well, none. It was Lord and Miller first.
Well, yes. They were directing they wrote and directed, and then...
Yeah. So it was Lord and Miller, and then it was Ron Howard, and then, like, you know, bringing the Star Wars guy. Yeah. So outside of that situation, like, his career was done when he was 50. Like...
Yeah, I mean...
Crazy.
The Solo thing is... It's so funny you bring it up, because yesterday we were talking Star Wars, Mel and I, yesterday about like how this franchise has somehow got away from them in a lot of ways.
They need Porkins and Beanzo. That's a character I'm creating. Beanzo.
But I genuinely think that Lawrence Kasdan, I mean, I don't know that his career is necessarily over per se. I mean, I could see him coming back with
something.
You know,
if it's necessarily over right now?
Yeah, I don't know that it's
75 years old. I mean, he could make something, but like he's...
I don't know that he directs. I mean, listen, we saw that he has a film maybe in post that's supposed to come out this year.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying he made other stuff. He's 72. He made other stuff. All I'm saying is like, you know,
his relevancy
Dreamcatcher, like, I have no doubt that he has done rewrites on 50 movies. I have no doubt that the guy is making tons of money. But the fact that, you know, the way he looks at his career, and I think the way the world looks at his career is he couldn't get anything going that had, you know, a film by Lawrence Kasdan on it that is a big deal.
Well, Darling Companion, which I vaguely remember. Do you remember this movie?
No.
By any chance? So it's the cast is Mark Duplass, Richard Jenkins, Diane Keaton, Kevin Kline, like great cast. Him and his daughter Meg wrote it. $12 million budget, made $795,000. It's not a lot of money. Clearly it was kind of dumped. Roger Ebert wrote, "It is depressing to reflect on the wealth of talent that conspired to make this inert and listless movie." I mean, damn. So it does feel like what can I say? I'm curious to see what this...
You're on his Wikipedia, right?
Yeah.
What do you think of his Sight and Sound list?
Oh, hold on. What is his... I sort of skimmed past.
2012 Sight and Sound
list. 2012 Sight and Sound list film. I'll read them for our listeners. Army of Shadows, Battle of Algier, Doctor Strangelove, The Godfather, Grapes of Wrath, Lawrence of Arabia, Out of the Past, Rules of the Game, Seven Samurai, Treasure of Sierra Madre. I mean, yeah. Okay, sure. All
pretty
fucking
chalk,
bangers.
Pretty chalk.
I mean, yeah. I think yours would be different. Mine would be different. But yeah, I mean...
I would have White Men Can't Jump.
And Major League.
Could you imagine if I actually got a vote in that? I just did 10 sports movies from the 90s.
Be great.
Little Giants, Ladybugs,
Field of Dreams.
The Cutting Edge.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's not much more to say about this movie, but I'll just say this. I didn't hate watching it. It has weirdly sort of stayed with me insofar as I found it very perplexing. It's a perplexing movie. I think you and I as writers found it perplexing because it seems to dodge so many rules. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there are the screenwriting 101 things that you're watching this film being like, you know, for instance, don't wait 45 minutes for your concept to kick in. Yeah. Don't just throw away, you know, lines that are significant to story. It's just, there's a lot of stuff in it that doesn't add up, but there's some stuff that works. That's really watchable. Crazy. I loved at the end of the film. So at the very end of the movie, Mumford goes to Hope Davis's house, and they have this conversation. He knocks on her door. The reason she finds out about him is because he's on Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh yes.
It's so good.
Which everybody in town is watching.
Everyone in town is watching it, including him. He just sits there and watches it just aghast.
Oh, God.
So, yeah. So he knocks on the door. She opens it and she's like, we were watching ER until someone called. Someone called them about it being on Unsolved yeah. Mysteries. I guess my question to you to wrap this up is that porch scene, okay, where he confesses and she says, you know, whatever. I remembered watching the scene and thinking, am I supposed to be rooting for him in this situation? Because like what he's done is unquestionably shitty. He's not a good guy. Am I rooting for him? I'm rooting for her and she loves him. So that's why I'm kind of rooting for them. But I just, it's very odd.
You're definitely supposed to be rooting for him, I think, because, yeah. you know, and I think that that is perplexing. And it's all, that's a very weird thing through the lens of 2022 when sure. mental health and mental health therapy has been.
Privacy?
I think it's been kind of normalized and mainstreamed to the point mm-hmm. that you, and I strongly agree with this, you can't mock it anymore. You
right.
can't right. Like calling a psychiatrist a shrink, you can't yes. do anymore, or making fun of people in therapy, you can't do anymore. Or you know that or if you do, you are a dick. And like this movie only kind of works if you look at the whole mental health, you know, industry as a yeah. fucking sham and a yep. fraud. Because he's a sham and a fraud, and yet he helped people
yep.
Better than a quote unquote real therapist did. Uh-huh. And he, you know, ultimately we're supposed to believe that this guy is a good guy, mm-hmm. Despite doing something that, you know, is horrible, just horrible. So yeah, we're supposed to be rooting for them. And, you know, like for like, I don't know, I kind of was. So,
and then like the last beat, which we mentioned, is him in the cop car being taken away to prison and the cop being like, hey, man, I heard you're the doctor. Can I tell you some of my problems? And the movie's last shot is on Mumford and his face just being like, what are you going to do? I guess I'll listen to this guy's problems. And you're just like, yeah. Did we learn nothing? Did you learn anything? Did anyone learn anything about themselves? What exactly am I, what's my takeaway? Like, what is this movie's take on mental health? It doesn't seem positive.
You know, it's I don't know. I've been trying to think of a movie. I've been trying to think of a movie that this reminds me of. And, yeah. you know, a much, 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 much better movie than this is School of Rock, where Jack Black does something similar.
Yes.
Right? Like, yes. that's mm-hmm. as bad. It's as bad as, you know, being a fake therapist, being a fake teacher. And why are we always rooting for him? Well, because, like, we spent some fucking time before understanding why he would do something like this. Sure. And you know, we know he's a decent guy. We know he's been stepped on. We know that he needs the money. We yeah. know that it was not something he planned, something that fell into his lap.
Sure.
Like, and, you know, and we're with him for, you know, an hour in the movie. When we see, like, everyone, frankly, and the other big difference is, like, everyone's gone to school and everyone knows that, like, you know, the way teachers generally are forced to operate is not the best.
You kind of just hit it on the nose, which is that, like, by us starting in media res does such a disservice to his character. If we had met him and he was struggling and we see him come to this town
yeah.
and we see him decide to pull this con, you're invested in him. I am not invested in this guy from credits to credits. I'm not even convinced that I even really care what happens to this guy by the end of the movie.
And yet, this is what's so weird. that is what you described is the setup for Happy Texas.
Yes. Right? Or any number of con artist movies.
But yeah. Say Happy Texas, because Happy Texas is about two guys who go into a small town with a plan and they have to pretend to be people they're not. And the fear is that they're going to be found out before they can rob this bank. Yeah. I think that movie's pretty bad for a lot of reasons. And I think
listen to our Happy Texas episode.
I think this movie's pretty bad too. But if I had to watch one of those two again, I think I'm watching Mumford.
I'm watching Mumford again too.
Only because like there's only one of it. And like there's only one movie that like did anything this fucking strange.
But I guess my point to you is that I'm not sure they're mutually exclusive. I think this movie could have been this movie with your synthetic women and your what have yous and your flashback, all that. There's nothing that really needs to change. It's just the setup that needs to change because it starts in a place where I was immediately struggling to lock into it. That's not a good place to be.
The things that in general, when you have a what essentially is a low concept movie. I think this is a pretty low concept movie.
Yes, yes.
The things that separate good low concept movies from bad low concept movies are the everything else, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And particularly the relationships, the dynamics, the dialogue, jokes. This movie is not that bad in those respects. The world building, the setting,
by and large,
casting. Yeah. Like it's like this movie has a lot of the stuff. Mm-hmm. In place, it's the structure that's so fucking perplexing.
It's weird from one of the greatest screenwriters that's ever been. So let's rate this.
All right,
what's your rating pre-podcast, what's your rating after the podcast?
I'll get you the real number.
Okay,
may as well.
Sure.
I gave it so much bad, offensive and dangerous, ludicrous, missed opportunities, terrible point of view and message, very watchable. I'm going to give it a 60.
What's your post-podcast?
63.
I mean, truly, we are almost exactly the same. I came into this with a 60. I had the same. I was just like, I mean, I don't know how much I can hate on this.
Yeah, I'm amazed you gave it a positive. Not after the conversation, but like,
I'm probably at a 65 now. Like I'm not, I haven't changed much. I mean, I think that this movie is truly bizarre in a way that we have not seen before. Yeah. A movie that's posing as innocuous, a movie that is posing as a sweet, quaint, little town movie.
But much like Dr. Mumford himself.
Much like Dr. Mumford himself, this
64!
Movie is
64.
This movie's posing as, you want to hang out with me? Why wouldn't you want to hang out with me?
Yeah.
And then halfway through, it's like, oh, I'm a fucking cokehead that's into like synthetic women.
Maybe, you know, you might have just, honestly, it's too late in the podcast to like re-podcast based on that reading of the movie. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Look, Mumford, what a discovery.
It's a discovery. Here's what I'll say to our listeners. I don't think you'll hate going to Mumford. I think you might want to hang out there for an hour and 40 minutes.
I don't think anyone hates, like, what's interesting is we've done so many, and I guess this was like a weird little subgenre. We've done so many small town movies.
We have.
So many, but like movies that are overtly small town movies. Yep. Like this and like the love letter movies that are about big stars going to small towns, like fucking Runaway Bride, Mystery Alaska's about a small town, all these like Placid's about a small town, all outer suburbs, inner, inner rural,
sure, sure,
you know, small towns with, you know, with
Field of Dreams, small town,
restaurant, yeah. Field of, well, that's an 89 movie, but still,
yeah, I'm just saying.
But we've done so many small town movies, and so many of them are like the worst. Like it's like, I mean, you know, they can't all be Groundhog Day, right? Like, this one's one of the better ones. Like this is one of those better ones.
I can't disagree with that. I think that's the right way to look at this too. Cause I do think that it's such a trope. I mean, it's a very American trope, right? These small town America, snow globey kind of thing. And it's very endearing. I understand as a writer and as a viewer. But to your point, if you don't do it well, or if you don't, I don't even know. Like, again, it comes back to specificity, but still,
it's
like,
always
it's just
cloying, and it's always it's always weirdly patronizing.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And you know exactly what you're going to get. You're going to get, you know, Vinny falling into the mud, mm-hmm. which, you know, another small town movie that I fucking love.
Sure. Great movie.
There's a reason you do these fish out of waters in small town all the time, because they work really well. Mm-hmm. This isn't really meant to be a fish out of water. This is like, I don't know, all of a sudden, like, the fish has fucking a gun.
And a synthetic female pelvis. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, good, that's Mumford.
We did it.
Thanks for listening. This will, I don't know what we're doing next, but it'll be great. You'll love it.
Yep.
All right. Bye, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.